$1.66. The Nhambiquara, however, had proved impervious to Rondon's efforts. They were still largely nomadic hunter-gatherers, settling down only during the rainy season. For most of the year, they slept under the most temporary and fragile of shelters, a half or quarter circle of palm branches that they had driven into holes dug into the sand. They would set up these shelters in the direction from which they expected to receive the most sun, wind, or rain, but they would disassemble them every morning and build new ones the next night. Unlike neighboring tribes, the Nhambiquara also slept on the ground rather than in a hammock, a practice for which the Paresi despised them. The Nhambiquara were also wholly uninterested in clothing. Some of the Paresi who worked for the telegraph stations had begun to wear shirts and even pants, but the Nhambiquara men still wore nothing more than a string around their waist, with, at the most, a tuft of dried grass or a scrap of cloth that served no purpose beyond pure ornamentation. The Nhambiquara women did not even wear that much. This determined nakedness never ceased to worry Rondon, who did not trust his soldiers around the Indian girls, and who knew that, if his men succumbed to this particular temptation, they would likely pay for it with their lives. An even greater danger to the telegraph line soldiers, and to all the progress that Rondon had made in his relationship with the Indians, was tribal warfare. Rondon had strictly forbidden his men ever to take sides in a tribal battle, no matter how seemingly brutal or unjust. In Utiariti, however, one man had recently defied this order, with potentially disastrous results. Shortly before the expedition had arrived there, a group of Nhambiquara had descended on the Paresi's village while their men were gone. Hearing the screams of their wives and mothers, the Paresi had rushed home, and a battle had broken out in full view of the telegraph station. The Nhambiquara were better, more experienced warriors than the Paresi, but the Paresi had a powerful ally, a telegraph line employee, the only man for nearly 100 miles who had a gun. Having grown fond of the Paresi, and having watched the Nhambiquara prey on them time and again, the man had stepped into the melee, raised his gun, and fatally shot a Nhambiquara warrior, enraging Rondon and putting at risk the precarious peace he had worked so long to achieve. Rondon's injunction against violence directed toward an Indian for any reason, was categorical. In fact, he valued the lives of the Amazonian Indians above his own life, or the lives of his men. Surely there was not a soldier in the Rondon Commission who could not recite by heart his colonel's now famous command, "Die if you must, but never kill." Rondon's success in the Amazon had depended on this dictum. It was the only reason the Indians had ever dared to trust him. As they had in the United States, Native Americans in Brazil had been exploited, enslaved, and slaughtered for centuries. Since 1500, the year the Portuguese explorer Pedro Alvarez Cabral is said to have discovered the region. In 1908, Hermann von Ehring, the German-born director of the São Paulo Museum, argued that it was a shame, but the Indians would surely not survive Brazilian ambitions, and they should not be allowed to stand in their way. "I feel for them as a man," he wrote, "but as a citizen in keeping with my political belief, I cannot stand by and watch the march of our culture halted by Indian arrows. And certainly the life of the backwoodsman and colonist is worth more to us than the life of the savage. The fate of the Indians is certain. Many of them will accept our culture. The remainder will continue to be our enemies and, as such, will gradually disappear." Unwittingly, however, von Ehring had ignited the greatest advancement in the cause of Indian rights that Brazil had ever witnessed. Outraged by the museum director's blatant disregard for Indian lives, von Ehring had even gone so far as to note in the article that it was worth registering here what the American General Custer said, "The only good Indian is the dead Indian." Rondon engaged him in a public debate. In 1910, the momentum generated by this debate resulted in the formation of Brazil's Indian Protection Service, SPI, the country's first agency devoted to the protection of its native inhabitants, and Rondon was named its first director. Rondon's brave and unyielding advocacy of the Amazonian Indian was to become his most important legacy, outshining even his achievements as an explorer. Whatever the merits of his philosophy, however, his approach was cold comfort to the soldiers he forced to practice it. In fact, so infamous were Rondon's expeditions into the interior that he had to pay his men 7 times what they made anywhere else. Even the cook aboard the Nyoac had known Rondon's reputation for losing his men's lives as he forged a path through Indian territory. When the Brazilian colonel invited him to join the descent of the River of Doubt, the cook replied in horror, "Sir, I have done nothing to deserve such punishment." Rondon refused even to let his men retaliate when they had been attacked. It was not unusual for his soldiers to have to watch helplessly while their friends died brutal deaths at the hands of Indians, and then have no ability to avenge their loss, no recourse but tears. "Let us weep," Rondon would tell them, "for I love this man who has perished for my sake. But I command you to do as he did. Never shoot." Rondon believed that his mission in protecting and pacifying the Indians was larger than his own life, larger than any of their lives. He would rather die than surrender his ideals, and he obliged his men to follow suit. Roosevelt, for his part, was not planning on sacrificing his expedition or the lives of any of his men on the altar of Rondon's ideals. As a young rancher in the Dakota Territories, Roosevelt had barked, "I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of every 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. By the time he became president, his views had tempered, and he, like Rondon, believed that the country's aim should be the Indians' ultimate absorption into the body of our people. However, the man he appointed as Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Francis Loop, made no effort to hide his belief that Indians would never be seamlessly integrated into the world of the white man. In fact, he argued that Indians should not be made United States citizens. "They are not fitted for citizenship's duties," he declared, "or able to take advantage of its benefits." Roosevelt would never completely shake off the model of the American Western frontier with which he had grown up. When he was in Dakota, the battles between the Indians and the pioneers were only just ending. There were still sporadic outbreaks here and there, and occasionally bands of marauding young braves were a menace to outlying and lonely settlements, he recalled. But many of the white men were themselves lawless and brutal, and prone to commit outrages on the Indians. Though Roosevelt had sympathy for the Indians and understood the injustices and cruelties that they had endured in South America as well as in North America, Rondon's passive pacifist approach was alien to his entire way of thinking. He was much more inclined to conquer than to be slaughtered. The stakes were rising, moreover, because with each passing day, the expedition was intruding deeper into Nhambiquara territory, and the Indians were becoming increasingly bold with Roosevelt and his men. Their gestures were friendly, as they clearly knew and liked Rondon, but the expedition members understood that the slightest insult or injury, whether real or simply perceived, could turn the Indians against them before they even realized what had happened. The Nhambiquara lived by the laws of the wilderness, which demanded that, as Roosevelt explained, "friends proclaim their presence. A silent advance marks a foe." During war, the Nhambiquara had perfected the art of the surprise attack. When preparing for a war, the chief of the band takes the men into the woods and tells them that there are bad people to the north which they must kill, observed Calvero Oberg, a Smithsonian anthropologist who studied the tribe in the mid-1940s. Then, after singing a war song, they set about making many arrows and war clubs. The night before the attack, they camp near the village of the enemy. The men paint their bodies with the sap of some latex tree, and their faces with uruku and charcoal. They then take leaves and stuff them into any holes in the ground or in trees around their camp. After all the holes are stopped up, they take the skin of an anteater, the skin of a toad, and the leaves of a tree, which are used in preventing rain, and burn them. The stopping of the holes is believed to prevent the enemy from hearing them. The chief remains at his spot and sings all night with the shamans. At dawn, the young men approach the huts of the enemy, stand in the doorway, and shout. And when the occupants awaken, they are shot down or clubbed. No one is spared. Conversely, to show their good intentions when they visited the expedition, the Indians would leave their weapons behind and call out to Roosevelt and his men from hiding places in the forest that surrounded the telegraph road. The members of the expedition would answer, inviting the Indians to visit their camp. The Indians would then shout again. The expedition would answer. Shout, answer, shout, answer. Until finally the Indians were certain that they were welcome, and the expedition was certain that they were coming as friends and not as attackers. Once in the camp, the Nambakara would get as close as physically possible to the white men, whom they found curiously pale, tall, and hairy. While Roosevelt was trying to write, they would gather around him so tightly that he would have to gently push them away so that he could move his arms. The Nambakara were taller and darker than the Parisi, with longer heads and hair cut into distinctive bowl-like bangs. Around Rondon, they were smiling and relaxed. Kermit liked them. "They are a very pleasant set," he wrote Bell, "and didn't look at all as if they had given Rondon all the trouble they have. They have small hands and feet, and really nice faces. It's melancholy to think how they will change when civilization comes here." Leo Miller, however, who, perhaps of all the members of the expedition, had the lowest opinion of Indians, was repelled by the quills and thin pieces of bamboo that the Nambakara men threaded through holes pierced into their upper lips and the septum of their noses, especially since the Indians clearly had no appreciation for the American concept of personal space. They had the unpleasant habit of coming close up to one and jabbering at a furious rate of speed, Miller wrote. This caused the librettes to move uncomfortably near one's eyes, and it was necessary at times to retreat a short distance in order to get out of range of the menacing ornaments. Roosevelt marveled that these sticks, which were roughly 6 inches long, did not bother the Indians, even when they ate. "They laughed at the suggestion of removing them," he wrote. "Evidently, to have done so would have been rather bad manners, like using a knife as an aid in eating ice cream." The Nambakara intrigued Roosevelt, and he enjoyed their company, but he would not let his guard down around them. He had heard vivid tales of their brutality toward the Parisi and Utiariti, and he had spent a night watching them dance in Juruena, only to wake up and find that they had left in the wee hours, taking with them two of the expedition's dogs. These Indians were, he wrote, "light-hearted robbers and murderers." While he was on this expedition, Roosevelt felt obliged to follow Rondon's lead. This was his country and his territory, and Roosevelt respected Rondon's authority as a colonel in the Brazilian military. However, nothing he saw suggested that Rondon's approach would produce anything but tragedy. His concerns were dramatically illustrated on February 11th, when the men made camp near the remains of an abandoned Indian village. After dinner, a few of the men wandered over to see what was left. Not far from the sagging and crumbling palm thatch huts, the men stumbled upon the graves of two Brazilian soldiers and an army officer who had been murdered by the Nambakara and then buried vertically, with their heads and shoulders sticking out of the ground. The most frightening aspect of these lonely graves was that the Indians who had killed these men were much further along the road of pacification, civilization, and friendship with the outside world than were the unknown Indians who lived on the banks of the River of Doubt. The Nambakara were violent and unpredictable, but at least they had forged a semblance of peace with Rondon. The Indians of the River of Doubt, in contrast, were utterly unknown even to Rondon, and there was no reason to think that they would welcome the expedition into their territory with any more tolerance or self-restraint than the Nambakara had shown when they had rained arrows down on Rondon at his first approach. Roosevelt and his men may have regarded themselves as explorers, but the Indians would know them only as invaders. With all of these worries weighing on his mind, Roosevelt was struck one last heavy blow just as he reached the River of Doubt. Throughout the overland journey, Rondon had assured the ex-president that the expedition would have enough provisions for every man who was to descend the river. When they took stock of their supplies, however, Rondon and Roosevelt together learned that the haphazard preparations for the journey and the grueling months since leaving Tapirapoan had taken a far greater toll than anyone had fully realized. Even in the best of circumstances, the remaining rations would not come close to feeding the 16 camaradas who were to do the hardest work of paddling the expedition's boat and portaging its equipment. At the very outset of their descent of an unmapped river, Roosevelt was forced to cut his own and the other officers' rations in half so that the camaradas on whom they depended could have any chance of surviving the journey. The expedition had now turned into a race against time. The survival of every man would depend on their collective ability to master the churning river, evade its ever-present dangers, and discover a route out of the deepest rainforest before their supplies ran out. Part 3. The Descent. Chapter 10. The Unknown. If Roosevelt and his men could have soared over the rainforest like the hawks that wheeled above them, the River of Doubt would have looked like a black piece of ribbon candy, nestled in an endless expanse of green. Here, at the start of its tortuous journey northward, the river was so tightly coiled that at times it doubled back on itself, and in every direction the jungle stretched, dense, impenetrable, and untouched, to the horizon. The expedition was finally preparing to descend into the Amazon basin from the highland plateau that it had just crossed. Even from the air, however, the river's path into the jungle lowlands was so capricious and the terrain so uneven that it frequently disappeared entirely beneath the dense green canopy, making it nearly impossible to follow. Rondon believed that the River of Doubt ultimately poured into the Madeira, the principal tributary of the Amazon River. On the basis of that educated guess, he had, before departing, sent a detachment of men to travel up the Madeira to the point where he calculated that he and Roosevelt would eventually emerge. The detachment, led by Lieutenant Antonio Piranesi, the man who had nearly lost his tongue and his life to a piranha during Rondon's harrowing 1909 telegraph expedition, was ordered to set up camp at the confluence of the two southern branches of a tributary of the Madeira called the Aripuanan. The Madeira, which is so large that its basin is more than twice the size of France, winds for more than 2,000 miles through western Brazil and has more than a dozen tributaries. As the Madeira's largest tributary, the Aripuanan was well known for its final lower reaches. But rapids and Indians had prevented even the most intrepid and ambitious rubber tappers from traveling more than a few hundred miles up its course. Rondon had instructed Piranesi to take a steamer up the Aripuanan as far as he could, and then go by canoe to the point at which the river was known to split into two long arms. He was to wait at this fork in the river in the hope that, 2 or even 3 months after starting down the River of Doubt, the Roosevelt-Rondon scientific expedition would appear on the horizon. If Rondon was right, and the expedition eventually reunited with Piranesi on the Aripuanan, it would mean two things. First, it would mean that Roosevelt had placed on the map of South America a river that was nearly 1,000 miles long as the Ohio or the Rhine. There would then be no question but that the River of Doubt was, in Rondon's words, a river whose importance would justify the idea of giving it Roosevelt's name. The scale of that achievement, however, would be directly proportional to the sacrifices it would require. If the expedition emerged where Rondon predicted, it also would mean that Roosevelt, Rondon, and their men had survived a journey as perilous as any in the history of Amazon exploration. In contrast to the broad, sweeping grandeur of the Amazon River itself, the thousands of tributaries that stream into it are wild and capricious. They tear through the jungle like wounded animals, thrashing their banks and spitting white foam into the branches of overhanging trees. The river's ferocity is caused not only by the great volume of water they carry. Taken by itself, the Madeira is equal in volume to the powerful Congo, the world's second largest river by volume after the Amazon itself. Or even by their plunge from highland plateau to lowland basin. Instead, the principal reason these rivers are nearly impossible to navigate is that they are studded with rapids that are produced as water flows over rock formations of contrasting degrees of hardness. The softer the rock, the more easily it erodes, exposing bars of hard bedrock that form ever steeper steps in the riverbed, making the water roil and churn as if a fire were blazing beneath it. The Madeira, which starts its journey near the Bolivia-Brazil border in the Brazilian highlands, has at least 30 major waterfalls and rapids, with 16 powerful cataracts in one 225-mile stretch alone. Everyone in the expedition understood that the River of Doubt, if it followed the path Rondon suspected, would be just as rapids-choked as the Madeira, if not more so. The difference between Roosevelt's expedition and those of the countless rubber tappers who had tried unsuccessfully to negotiate the Amazon's wild tributaries was that Roosevelt was going to descend the River of Doubt, not attempt to fight his way up it. This strategy would allow him to harness the river's great strength rather than oppose it. But it represented a gamble of life-or-death proportions, because from the moment the men of the expedition launched their boats, they would no longer be able to turn around. The river would carry them ever deeper into the rainforest, with whatever dangers that might entail. When they reached a series of rapids, they would have to portage around them, or mumble a prayer and plunge ahead. In either case, the option of returning the way they came was no longer available to them. They would find a way through, or they would perish in the attempt. On the spot where Rondon had abandoned his exploration of the River of Doubt 5 years earlier, the Rondon Commission had built a simple wooden bridge to straddle the river's roughly 65-foot expanse. As Roosevelt at last stood on that bridge, listening to the swift, muddy water slap against the warped planks beneath his feet, he peered into the dark stretch of jungle ahead of him. This world, which he was about to enter for better or worse, was strange and utterly unfamiliar. And while his first glimpse into it was exciting, it was also deeply sobering. No one, not even the inscrutable Rondon, could predict what was around the next bend. Roosevelt was about to become an explorer in the truest and most unforgiving sense of the word. It was an opportunity he had dreamed of from his earliest childhood. Now, however, he realized that he would be called on to pay the full cost of his ambitions, and he found himself gravely unprepared for what might lie ahead. After months of inattention, Roosevelt had now come face to face with the acute logistical shortcomings and rapidly escalating risks that his own casual approach to the expedition and its route had produced. Roosevelt, Rondon, and their men were about to begin the most difficult leg of their journey, but they were already at the limits of their endurance. After spending more than a month slogging through the muddy highlands, with long days on muleback, nearly constant downpours, illness, worry, death, and sorrow, the men were exhausted, homesick, and wary, not just of the river they were about to descend, but also of one another. To the Americans, the overland journey had appeared chaotic and shockingly disorganized. To the Brazilians, on the other hand, the Americans must have seemed selfish and demanding. Father Zahm had certainly been the worst offender, but the comfort of all the Americans had always come first, even before the Brazilians' basic needs. Unknown to Roosevelt, Rondon had not only ordered his men to eat less so that the Americans could eat more, but had intentionally overloaded the pack oxen and abandoned entire crates of the camaradas' provisions in the hope that he would not have to ask the Americans to leave behind any of their ponderous baggage. Until now, the wrangling over provisions and equipment had all seemed vaguely theoretical in nature, revolving around a river journey that was always distant in both time and geography. At the river's edge, however, the immense difficulties and uncertainties of the task that Roosevelt had taken on were suddenly transformed into urgent realities. Everything that the men of the expedition knew about the journey ahead underscored the dangers that they would face from this point forward. Even more disturbing than what they knew was what they did not know. The obvious riddle of the river's course was only one of a thousand potentially lethal mysteries that now surrounded them. As they plunged deeper and deeper into the jungle, the riot of nature that enveloped them, from the crowded canopy overhead to the buzzing insect-laden air around their faces to the unseen depths of the Black River, became increasingly strange, unfamiliar, and threatening. To say nothing of the constant threat of Indian attack, which transformed every shadow into a potential enemy. The most immediate problem was how to negotiate the river itself. Shifting whirlpools and whitewater rapids were obvious dangers, but even a seemingly benign ripple could be deadly. The danger was in the eddy line, the point at which the current, which is running downstream, collides with the eddy, which is heading upstream, causing a powerful and chaotic swirl of water just under the surface. To deal with the unpredictable dangers of powerful rapids, American river explorers had tried a variety of specialized boats, eventually developing unusual swayback drift boats with a shallow draft and a high aft and stern, which made it possible to ride out the churning white water. The remoteness of the River of Doubt and the chaos of the overland journey, however, meant that Roosevelt and his men would have no such equipment. Although Roosevelt had left New York with more boats than he would possibly need in the Amazon, he had, incredibly enough, arrived at the river with no boats at all. He had chosen to leave Father Zahm's 800-pound motorboats, the Edith and the Notre Dame, in Rio de Janeiro, after it had become clear that they were far too heavy to haul through the rainforest. Then, during the overland journey, the men had agreed to abandon Fiala's Canadian canoes in Utiariti when their failing oxen could no longer carry even those light watercraft. Now that the expedition had finally reached the River of Doubt, it found itself with 22 men, hundreds of pounds of supplies, and not a single boat. Forced to find a local substitute for such vital equipment, the men were obliged to make do with a set of 7 roughly hewn dugouts that Rondon purchased from a group of Nambikara Indians and which were now tethered to the base of the telegraph bridge. Rondon assured Roosevelt that these dugouts were all recently built, but they had been built by one of the Amazon's most primitive tribes, a group that was reviled by other tribes for its lack of even the most rudimentary hammock. There was no comparison between these massive, clumsy dugouts and the sleek 160-pound canvas-covered canoes that Fiala had ordered for the expedition and which were now carrying him safely down the Papagayo River. Little more than hollowed-out tree trunks, the dugouts would be nearly impossible to maneuver when the expedition encountered rapids. In contrast to drift boats, which are designed to ride high through bucking waters, and to facilitate the agile changes of direction needed to avoid submerged boulders and other lethal obstacles, the dugouts provided only minimal flotation and had little or no capacity for steering, obliging their occupants to plow through or into whatever lay ahead. Even their buoyancy left much to be desired, as the men of the expedition quickly discovered. The fully loaded dugouts left them sitting only a few inches above the surface, and were quickly swamped in rough water. These particular dugouts, moreover, were in questionable condition. In fact, Roosevelt's recounting of them sounded ominously like a description of the 7 dwarfs. "One was small, one was cranky, and 2 were old, waterlogged, and leaky," he wrote. "The other 3 were good." The expedition's unanticipated reliance on such primitive boats had implications far beyond mere efficiency or comfort, or even the increased risk of drowning and other disasters. In the jungle, the boats were not simply a form of transportation. but the expedition's principal refuge from a broad variety of natural enemies. Every time the men of the expedition were forced to leave the relative sanctuary of the boats, they would have to expose themselves to the dangerous, unseen, and unpredictable creatures that surrounded them, on land and in the water. At up to 2,500 pounds apiece, the dugouts were also enormously heavy. Should the river prove so impassable that the expedition was forced to portage around it, the boats would be an excruciating burden and distraction as the men, vulnerable and exhausted, tried to haul them through the forest. The weight of the craft also greatly increased the stakes of even a minor mishap. Any slip with the heavy, waterlogged boats, during a portage, in the rushing current, or merely during routine loading and unloading as they bobbed near the shore, could easily crush a man's hand or leg if it did not kill him outright. In the harsh, primitive conditions that lay ahead, the prospect of such accidents took on grave significance. The men understood that on the River of Doubt, the difference between any injury and death was likely just a matter of time. From their rough, wet seats just above the waterline, Roosevelt and his men could see many of the predators that surrounded them in the river, and could only imagine those that waited below the inky surface. In the tangled vines that shrouded the shoreline, what appeared to be partially submerged logs suddenly blinked and slid beneath the surface, revealing themselves as caimans, South American alligators. Rhythmic eddies in the water betrayed the passage of anacondas, which can weigh as much as 500 pounds. The men were by now well acquainted with the razor-toothed piranha. Every time they were forced to wade while maneuvering their sluggish dugouts, they would be at risk of attack. If the rapids on the River of Doubt proved impassable and the men were driven ashore, they would face even greater dangers than on the river. The insects had already begun to swarm, brought out in droves by the ceaseless rain. The gravest threat came from mosquitoes, which carried everything from malaria to yellow fever. But perhaps the worst torment came from piums. These minuscule black flies gorge themselves on blood like mosquitoes, but descend by the hundreds, inflicting red pinpoint bites that not only itch, but leave their victims looking as if they have been shot with buckshot. In the rainforest, it seemed that every living thing, from animals to insects to bacteria, was ready to attack, whether in offense or self-preservation. Some of the world's deadliest serpents were coiled on the forest floor and in the low branches of trees. There were poisonous frogs, lithe, stealthy jaguars, and collared peccaries, wild pigs known to run in packs of more than 300 animals. Then there were the Indians, who could easily remain invisible to Roosevelt and his men, even if they chose to attack. Compounding all these dangers was the critical factor of time. The kind of delays that they had experienced during the overland journey would be more than frustrating while they were on the river. They would be deadly. Not only would each extra day they were forced to spend on the river leave the men more vulnerable to predators, disease, and Indian attack, but it would bring them that much closer to starvation. Every time their clumsy dugouts obliged them to portage around rapids, the men would expend more precious calories and would have to spend more time attempting to hunt or find food, slowing the expedition even further. In the face of such evident flaws in the expedition's preparations and the potential risks associated with any delay, the differences between its American and Brazilian leaders grew wider. Roosevelt and Kermit wanted nothing more than to move ahead quickly. Having put his life on hold for this expedition, all that Kermit asked of it was swift, uneventful progress. Even for Roosevelt, this trip, which was a rare opportunity for both adventure and achievement, was simply another trophy, one that he could keep next to his memories of his ranching days in the West, the Battle of San Juan Hill, and his 7 years in the White House. If he survived, he would return as quickly as possible to the United States and the hectic political life that he had led before he had even set foot on South American soil. For Rondon, however, the descent of the River of Doubt was not an isolated event. It was an integral part of a quarter century of extraordinary effort and sacrifice. When Lauro Müller asked him to accompany Roosevelt into the Amazon, Rondon had been in the midst of one of the most difficult periods of a notably difficult career. He had been fighting to keep his six soldiers alive and his telegraph line moving forward, while at the same time desperately trying to prepare for what he hoped would be the line's November 1914 inauguration. Rondon had accepted the assignment because he knew that Theodore Roosevelt could give his commission the kind of public attention that it needed in order to maintain its funding and political support from the Brazilian government. But if he was going to descend this river, he intended to carry out his work with the same discipline and rigorous attention to detail that he had applied to each of his expeditions, no matter how grueling or dangerous. This expedition was an opportunity to write history, and Rondon was not going to rush through it, whatever the cost. Camped at the water's edge, the men made their final preparations for the start of their river journey. A few days earlier, they had divided their provisions between the River of Doubt expedition and the separate Ji Paraná expedition, which Miller and Amilcar would lead. Now, under Lira's direction, the camaradas did their best to organize the remaining boxes of rations, coils of rope, bags of survey equipment, tents, cooking supplies, and hunting gear, and then packed them in a way that they hoped would protect them from rain, sun, and rapids. As the men inventoried their baggage, their concern about Fiala's preparations began to turn into alarm. Most of his equipment was useless, or, as it has been appropriately termed, doodle dabs, Miller wrote to Frank Chapman at the American Museum of Natural History. The rations were an even larger and more critical problem than the equipment. When the men pried open several of Fiala's crates, they were stunned by what they found. "We discovered here whole cases of olive oil, cases of mustard, malted milk, stuffed olives, prunes, applesauce, etc., etc., even Rhine wine," Miller told Chapman. "Such gourmet condiments were all nice enough in their place," he wrote, "but on such a tremendous journey, they were useless." Even if they had begun the expedition with full rations, Fiala had assumed that the men would rely heavily on hunting to supplement their diet. "For meat," he wrote, "the rubber hunter and explorer depends upon his rifle and fishhook." Each food tin weighed 27 pounds, and it would have been nearly impossible for the expedition's dugout canoes to carry enough tins to feed every man every day. With no experience in the rainforest, however, Fiala had no basis for his assumption that the expedition would be able to find enough game to sustain itself, and his expectations would prove to be wildly unrealistic. Having come this far, Roosevelt and his men now had no choice but to make the best of what they had. They spent most of February 26th, the day before their departure, repairing the dugouts. They finally decided to lash the two old, waterlogged, and leaky boats together to form a more stable balsa or raft, and they tied the cranky dugout to one of the three good ones. Since balsas are able to safely carry more weight than our single canoes, these four dugouts would haul the preponderance of the expedition's provisions, equipment, and men. Each boat, however, would have to carry a heavy load. Even though Roosevelt and Rondon had repeatedly reduced the size of the expedition and the amount of its baggage since the pack trains left Tapirapuan more than a month earlier, they still had 22 men to feed, clothe, and equip for a journey that could last several months. To keep the baggage as light as possible, the officers agreed to share tents. Roosevelt, Kermit, and Cherry under one fly, and Rondon, Lira, and Dr. Cajazeira under another. And the 16 camaradas would sleep wherever they could find a soft spot for their hammocks and shelter from the rain. They did pack one other light tent, but that was reserved for anyone who became too ill to walk. Despite all of these efforts, the loaded dugouts still sank so low in the river that the camaradas had to tie long bundles of buriti palm branches to their sides to help improve their buoyancy. Roosevelt was concerned about riding so heavily in the swift water, but he had adopted a philosophical attitude about the danger that he faced on the River of Doubt. "If our canoe voyage was prosperous, we would gradually lighten the loads by eating the provisions," he wrote. "If we met with accidents, such as losing canoes and men in the rapids, or losing men in encounters with Indians, or if we encountered overmuch fever and dysentery, the loads would lighten themselves." While the members of the River of Doubt team loaded the last of their belongings into their long, heavy canoes, Amilcar and Leo Miller, the naturalist who had been relegated to the descent of a different river, stood on the bridge, listening to their shouts and grunts of effort, and watching the general commotion that accompanies the commencement of any long journey. We had looked forward in eager anticipation to the end of the long ride across the Brazilian Chapadão and the beginning of river work, he wrote. But now that the goal had been attained, the division of the expedition seemed to have come all too soon. In a gesture of confidence in the successful outcome of his expedition, Roosevelt borrowed $520 from Miller's museum money so that he could treat his men to a feast at the first semblance of a store that they found near the mouth of the River of Doubt, wherever that might be. He promised to pay Miller back in Manaus, the rubber boom city on the Rio Negro, where they all hoped to meet at the end of their respective journeys. That same day, Roosevelt also asked a favor of Cherry. "Roosevelt asked me to cut his hair," the naturalist wrote his wife, shocked that he had just groomed a former president of the United States. "I did the job, but the colonel refused to let me take his picture after I had finished." Finally, everything was in place, and just after 12 noon on February 27, 1914, Roosevelt carefully climbed inside his narrow dugout and found a seat on a bag that had been stuffed as tight as a sausage. As soon as the camaradas pushed off the banks, he immediately felt himself being swept up in the river's rushing current. The last thing he heard before he was carried too far down the river for Miller's voice to reach him was a hearty, "Good luck!" For several minutes we stood upon the fragile structure that bridged the unexplored river and stared at the dark forest that shut out our erstwhile leader and his Brazilian companions from view, Miller would later write. And then, filled with misgivings as to whether or not we should ever see them again, we turned our thoughts to the task before us. Chapter 11. Pole and Paddle, Axe and Machete. Carried along by the swift water, the expedition's 7 dugouts snaked through the forest single file. The jungle was thickest at the river's edge, where the trees crowded along the banks in a timeless battle for sunlight. They were matted together with vines and epiphytes that trailed in the water like heavy curtains and completely obscured the muddy bank. From his position in the last and largest canoe, which had a carrying capacity of 1.25 tons, Roosevelt, along with Cherry, Dr. Cajazeira, and their 3 paddlers, could see the other 6 dugouts floating in a long, broken chain ahead of him. Directly in front of him were the 2 balsas, which carried 8 camaradas and most of the expedition's baggage, but were even more difficult to steer than the rest of the boats. Rondon, Lira, and 3 paddlers rowed in the 2nd dugout, and Kermit and 2 camaradas sat in the smallest canoe at the head of the expedition. "As we drifted and paddled down the swirling brown current, through the vivid, rain-drenched green of the tropic forest, the trees leaned over the river from both banks," Roosevelt wrote. "There were many palms, both the boriti, with its stiff fronds like enormous fans, and a handsome species of bacaba, with very long, gracefully curving fronds. In places the palms stood close together, towering and slender, their stems a stately colonnade, their fronds an arched fretwork against the sky." Roosevelt reveled in the beauty and variety of the plant life and the fragrant scents that were blown to us from flowers on the banks. But he was puzzled by a distinct and eerie absence of sound. In the midst of all this lush life was a seemingly incongruent stillness. Rarely we heard strange calls from the depths of the woods, he wrote, but for the most part the forest was silent. Cherry, too, was struck by how empty the jungle seemed. Very little animal life was seen along the shore, he scribbled in his diary. While Roosevelt and Cherry studied the rainforest, their paddlers kept their eyes on the river. Pulling the dugout through the water with their long wooden paddles, they searched for a telltale ripple, their only warning that a fallen tree lay just below the surface. The rainy season downpours that had been such a source of misery to the men on their overland journey had caused the river to swell to such a height that most of the sunken trees and boulders were safely buried under several feet of water. Some, such as the water-loving Boritana palms, continued to grow and thrive, although they were fully submerged, the current shaking their broad crowns like a strong wind. Other fallen trees, however, still lay close to the surface, and, whenever they appeared, the current seemed invariably to drive the expedition's canoes straight down on top of them. It was then, Roosevelt wrote, that the muscles stood out on the backs and arms of the paddlers as stroke on stroke they urged us away from and past the obstacle. The strength and skill of the camaradas was evident as they maneuvered their craft down the river. Rondon had hired rugged young men in Tapirapoan to be their paddlers and porters. They were a strapping set, Roosevelt wrote admiringly. They were expert rivermen and men of the forest, skilled veterans in wilderness work. They were lithe as panthers and brawny as bears. They swam like water dogs. They were equally at home with pole and paddle, with axe and machete. Roosevelt realized, however, that great difficulty often brought out the worst in a man. Deep in the Amazon, the expedition was utterly isolated and far from help of any kind. The camaradas, who outnumbered the officers nearly 3-1, could mutiny as easily as sailors at sea. They were all capable men, and most of them were brave, but they had lived a hard life. They looked, Roosevelt wrote, like pirates in the pictures of Howard Pyle and Maxfield Parrish. One glance at them revealed the almost unbridgeable difference between their hard-scrabble world and Roosevelt's refined and privileged one. For clothing, they had brought along nothing more than the thin shirts and ragged pants that they wore, and most of them were barefoot. Their feet and hands were as hard and gnarled as their rough-hewn paddles. Their faces, some bright and cheerful, others dark and glowering, were usually obscured by their slouching and soiled hats. It would take time for the officers, especially the Americans, to get to know their paddlers and to learn those on whom they could rely, even trusting them with their own lives, and those on whom they should never turn their backs. Even Roosevelt's own boatmen represented the extremes of good and bad among the camaradas. His steersman, a black man from Mato Grosso named Luis Correa, and his paddler, Antonio Paresi, a member of the peaceful Paresi Indian tribe that the expedition had met in Utiariti, were two of the best men in the expedition. Over the course of the journey, both of them would earn Roosevelt's respect by proving that they not only knew the rainforest, but were willing to work hard for the success of the expedition. The third camarada in Roosevelt's boat, however, was Julio de Lima, the broad-shouldered, hot-tempered Brazilian who had attacked another man with a knife during the overland journey. Apparently, Amilcar had not shared his concerns about Julio with Rondon, because not only had the volatile camarada been chosen among the select group of men who were to descend the River of Doubt, but he was now Roosevelt's own bowman. From the moment their boats were swept into the unknown, Rondon set his plan for the expedition into motion. The Brazilian colonel was interested not in adventure, but in geographical precision, and he was determined to survey the river carefully and completely, from its headwaters to its mouth. Little more than a century earlier, Alexander von Humboldt, the world-renowned German naturalist and explorer, had conducted the first thorough cartographical survey of South America, producing hundreds of maps based on 700 observations. Filling in these maps with the detail necessary to make them truly useful was an ongoing project, one that had met with varying degrees of success over the ensuing century. By the early 20th century, the existing maps of the Brazilian interior were largely and notoriously wrong, indicating mountains where none existed and rivers misplaced by hundreds of miles. A significant part of Rondon's job over the past 24 years had been not only adding to the cartographic knowledge of his continent, but correcting these mistakes. There were no reference points in the vast jungle, so the men would have to rely on celestial navigation to tell them where they were. To determine latitude and longitude, they used the same instrument that Humboldt himself had used, a sextant, which measures the angle between the horizon and the sun, moon, or stars. To chart the river from point to point, Rondon instituted a fixed station method of survey, one of the most accurate methods, but also the most labor-intensive. Not only did it require repeated, detailed measurements, but it also demanded frequent stops, especially on a river that wound as tightly as the River of Doubt. For the sake of accuracy, Rondon was more than willing to endure the tedium, grueling work, and danger that the fixed station survey demanded. However, as in many great undertakings, the expedition's commander would not suffer alone. In the lead canoe, Kermit had accepted the unenviable job of placing the sighting rod that Lyra and Rondon would use to make their measurements. Kermit and his paddlers would find a spot that afforded the longest unimpeded view both upstream and downstream, usually at a bend in the river, land their boat and, using a machete, cut away the thick branches and vines that covered the bank. Fighting off swarms of biting ants and angry wasps, Kermit would plant his sighting rod, a slim pole on which a red disc and a white disc had been positioned 1 meter apart, in the thin black leaf litter under his feet. Lyra would then use a telemeter to establish the distance between his canoe and the sighting rod, and Rondon would consult his compass and record the river's direction. The river twisted and turned so capriciously, curving literally toward every point of the compass, Roosevelt remarked, that Kermit had to land, cut away the vegetation, and set up the sighting rod 114 times that first day alone. Roosevelt was not pleased with the fixed station survey. Not only did it slow the expedition to a glacial pace, the boats traveled only 6 miles in 5 hours, but it placed his son in a particularly dangerous position. If there were sunken trees, hidden whirlpools, sudden waterfalls, or hostile Indians, Kermit would encounter them first. In spite of his concerns, however, Roosevelt refrained from asking Rondon to adopt a faster method of survey. This was Rondon's country and Rondon's expedition, more than his own, and Roosevelt was determined to respect his co-commander's wishes as long as he could. He planned, he wrote, simply to keep an eye on the expedition, maintaining a close supervision over everything that was done, but being more than courteous and polite and friendly with my Brazilian companions. After only 2 hours on the river, Roosevelt, whose canoe had long since passed the two slow surveying boats, instructed his paddlers to pull over. Leaning over the sides of the dugout to grasp leafy branches that overhung the river, the camaradas pulled as close to the overgrown shore as they could, and then used a rope to tether the boat to a tree. The six men then settled in to wait for their companions, their boat rocking in the current, the rain and sun alternately drenching and drying them. Finally, after 2 more hours had passed with no sign of the surveying canoes, Roosevelt ordered the camaradas to make camp. It was only 4 p.m., but they could not go forward without the rest of the expedition, and they had no idea when they would all be reunited. The expedition's first camp on the River of Doubt was little more than a crude clearing on the river's edge. After making their way through the dense bushes and trees that crowded every inch of the shoreline and leaned far out over the river itself, the men were able to find a dry, level patch of ground at the top of a steep, 100-yard incline. But fighting back the jungle was no easy task. With axes and machetes, the camaradas slowly began to cut away small trees and heavy vines, all crawling with a wide array of stinging, biting insects. Eventually, they were able to form a little open island in the sea of trees, and they began hauling up bags from the dugouts, setting up the officers' two tents, and tying their own simple hammocks to sturdy trunks. By the time Kermit, Rondon, Lyra, and their six paddlers appeared, filthy and exhausted, the sun was already setting, and Franca, the cook, had, as he had time and again for the past month, miraculously started a fire from sodden wood. As the men sat around the sputtering campfire, the rain tapered off, leaving a clear, star-scattered sky above them. Beyond their little circle of light, however, the jungle was so black that, had a sudden rain doused their fire, the men would not have been able to see their own hands, much less one another. Only 6 miles into their expedition, they could already feel their isolation. But as they sank into their hammocks that night, their first on the banks of the River of Doubt, little time was wasted on worry. Exhaustion descended, as heavy and inescapable as the tropical humidity, and the men quickly fell asleep. Chapter 12. The Living Jungle. When Roosevelt emerged from his thin balloon silk tent on the morning of February 28, 1914, he stepped into the narrow clearing that his men had carved between water and forest. Before him rushed the River of Doubt, dark, swollen, and littered with debris from fallen trees. Having overflowed its banks, it coursed through the forest on either side in wayward streams and rivulets, picking up clots of leaves and displaced birds' nests, and filling the jungle with a glass-like floor of water that mirrored the canopy above. The expedition's dugouts rocked uneasily at their moorings, looking as unreliable at dawn as they had the afternoon before. Although Roosevelt had hunted and camped in forests throughout the United States, marveling at California's enormous redwoods, he had never seen anything like the prodigy of nature that surrounded him now. The massive trees rose so high that their crowns disappeared in the tangle of branches and flicker of sunlight above his head. Branches of neighboring trees wound around one another like interlaced fingers, and heavy epiphytes unfurled from the treetops like a ship's rigging. In the early morning light, the scene that Roosevelt beheld was a breathtaking tableau of timeless nature, tranquil and apparently unchanging. That impression, however, could hardly have been more dangerous or deceiving. For, even as the men of the expedition gazed in awe at the natural beauty surrounding them, the creatures of the rainforest were watching back, identifying them as intruders, assaying their potential value, surveying their weaknesses, and preparing to take whatever they might have to give. Far from its outward appearance, the rainforest was not a garden of easy abundance, but precisely the opposite. Its quiet, shaded halls of leafy opulence were not a sanctuary, but rather the greatest natural battlefield anywhere on the planet, hosting an unremitting and remorseless fight for survival that occupied every single one of its inhabitants every minute of every day. Though frequently impossible for a casual observer to discern, every inch of space was alive. From the black teeming soil under Roosevelt's boots to the top of the canopy far above his head, and everything was connected. A long, linked mat of fungi under the soil consumed the dead and fed the living, completing an ever-changing cycle of remarkable life and commonplace death, which had throbbed without pause for millions of years, and of which Roosevelt and his men, knowingly or not, had now become a part. Unlike the woods of New England, where Roosevelt had spent years exploring and learning about nature, the rainforest floor was not covered with thick leaf litter or plant life, but appeared largely empty, characterized only by a shallow layer of soil shot through with thin, white, thread-like fibers. Just as unusual, each tree in the Amazon rainforest appeared to be nearly unique. Many trees had commonly shaped leaves, but stands or groups